It helps understand that there are four basic topics in AP statistics. And so one of the first things you might do when you look at a problem is decide which of the four topics it falls under. The first topic is data description. You can tell that you've been given this kind of problem when you're given data that you need to plot, or you're given a plot of data to interpret. And that's what been is meant by data description. You could have a box plot that's used to determine normality or something like that. You could have a scatter plot that's determined the relationship between two variables. That all falls under data description. The next category is experimental design, where you're trying to either come up with a procedure for doing a study or comment on a procedure that was done for a study. The third topic is probability. That's where we started this class, where you talk about the probability of an event occurring or the expected value of a random variable. And finally, we have statistical inference. That's all the things with confidence intervals and t-tests and or hypothesis tests in general. Okay, so those are the four topics, and I strongly recommend anytime you see a question, just quickly trying to classify which of those four topics it falls into, and that'll make it easier to decide what to do next. Okay, now I'm going to walk through each of the four topics in more detail. First, data description. Keywords there listed, things like median, mean, mode, so on. Skewed, remember let's go down to the list of things to remember. Skewed to the right means that the mean is higher than the median. So an example of something that's skewed to the right is the distribution of wealth. There are a few very wealthy people and a lot of people who have below the mean wealth. So someone like Bill Gates is a lot farther to the right of the median than a poor person is to the left of the median. So he raises the mean to the right. Bill Gates raises the mean of wealth to the right, and that's why the mean is higher than the median when you're skewed to the right. The opposite would be skewed to the left, where the mean would be lower than the median. Okay, the next thing to remember is the rule of thumb for calculating an outlier. You first take the interquartile range and multiply it by 1.5, and we can call that a magic number or whatever. We add that number to the top quartile to get the boundary for an outlier on the high side, and then we subtract it from the bottom quartile to get the boundary for an outlier on the low side. Next thing is a scatter plot shows a correlation between two variables, versus a side-by-side box plot, which shows a comparison of two variables. So if you're trying to, let's say, compare the test scores of two different classes, you would use something like a side-by-side box plot. If you were trying to see whether two variables have a relationship, let's say education and income, then you would use something like a scatter plot. If you're looking to see whether a distribution is normal or skewed, you can use box plot, stem plot, or a dot plot. Any of those will do. Regressions are also used simply for data description. You can have a power regression, which is ax to the b, and if b is less than 1, you can have a concave down function. With the exponential regression, a b to the x, you're always showing concave up. For a linear regression, there are two formulas for the slope. They're equivalent formulas. There's b is equal to r sy over sx. R is the correlation coefficient. Sy is like the standard deviation of y, it's the sample standard deviation of y, and Sx is the sample standard deviation of x. Or the other formula is b is equal to the Sxy over Sx squared. Sxy is the sum of the x minus x bars times y minus y bars, and fx squared is x minus x bar squared. So that's another formula for b. The intercept in a regression is simply y bar minus bx bar. It's the mean of y minus b times the mean of x. Also, for a given value of xi, the predicted value of y, which we call y hats of I, is equal to a plus bxi. And the residual is the actual yi minus the predicted value. Okay, so that's it for data description. The next topic is experimental design. And let's just walk through the keywords. An observational study is something where you compare people as you find them. You just observe what's going on. You don't select which people to give the treatment to. Whoever gets the treatment is whoever happened to have the treatment. In an experiment, the designer decides who is going to get the treatment and who is not going to get the treatment. A random sample means that you randomly assign the treatment versus the non-treatment. Stratified random sample is when you choose particular numbers in particular categories. The example that I use is the Federal Reserve study of consumer finances, where they take a larger sample of wealthy people in order to make sure that they get enough wealthy people to describe their behavior. But then when you convert that back to talk about the population as a whole, you've got to weight the wealthy people lower because you took a larger, deliberately took a larger sample of them. So that's a stratified random sample. Voluntary response sample is where you only people who volunteer to participate in the study participate. There are a lot of potential biases with that. Convenience sample means just picking the people who are easiest to get to. Again, there are biases with that. Block design means that you try to reduce the sampling variability by putting people into blocks. For example, if men and women have different heart disease rates and you're trying to test a heart drug, you want to make sure that you don't put more men in the treatment group and more women in the control group, so you give out the treatment in blocks. You give half the men the treatment and half the women the treatment, let's say. Okay, blind is trying to control for the placebo effect, so you don't tell the person whether they're getting the treatment or a placebo. Double blind, you're trying to control for the possibility that the evaluator of an experiment might be biased by knowing who got the treatment and who didn't, so you don't tell who's evaluating the results, who got the treatment and who didn't. So if you were trying to test the effect of a ADD drug on behavior and the evaluation of the behavior was going to be done by an evaluator who's subjectively looking at people to see whether the in deciding whether they were more or less ADD, then you don't want to tell the evaluator who got the treatment and who got the placebo. A lurking variable is a variable that you do not control for that could affect the results, and a confounding effect is when the lurking variable could bias the results in a study. For example, if you were trying to look at the effect of college education on earnings, a lurking variable is the different ability that people have, and that could become confounded with the effect of college, so that you, in your study, you might say that college raises income by 50%, but it could be that 30% of that or more has to do with the ability of the people to begin with, and they would have had those higher incomes without going to college, and that would be a case of confounding effect. The issue of causality, I'll bring up in a second, and then the final topic to remember is simulation. Remember, it is easier to infer causality from an experiment than from an observational study. When you just observe two things that are correlated, it may be that one causes the other, or that they're both being caused by some third factor. When you do an experiment and the experimenter controls who gets what, the treatment or the placebo, then you're much more likely to be able to infer causality. And finally, block design is a way to reduce the amount of random variation in the results. Block design cannot reduce bias if there's bias. All it does is reduce variation. In that sense, it's like taking a larger sample size. Okay, on to the next main topic, which is probability, and that's the one we started this course with. Keywords include conditional probability. Remember that one. A Venn diagram, a tree diagram, concept of independence, probability of success and failure, what we call the failure model, sample space, expected value, random variable, normal random variable, binomial random variable, geometric random variable. Those are the probability words. Okay, so words that indicate conditional probability include given, if, and of. Words that indicate joint probability include both and. So if we're talking about the probability of both A and B occurring, that means the probability of A and B. If we're talking about the probability of B occurring if A occurs, then we're talking about the probability of B given A, or B slash A. Okay, the next thing to remember is two events are independent if and only if the probability of the joint event, A and B, occurring is equal to the probability of one event times the probability of the other event. Next, on failure models, if all the engines have to fail in order for a boat to be stranded, then the probability of getting home is going to be 1 minus the probability that all the engines fail. And of course, the probability that all the engines fail is the probability of one engine failing taken to the nth power. And then if that's for the case where all the engines have to fail, you could have a different model in which one component has to fail and then everything fails. That's like the old-fashioned Christmas lights model, and then you work the probabilities differently with that one. Next, the rules for random variables. This is very important to get this straight. So if y is equal to a plus bx, that is, x is a random variable and y is a new random variable equal to a plus bx. An example would be converting Fahrenheit to centigrade. You would use that kind of a formula, y equals a plus bx. Then the expected value of y is equal to a plus b times the expected value of x, and the variance of y is equal to b squared times the variance of x. Or the standard deviation of y is equal to b times the standard deviation of x. Okay, so all those things are useful. You'll often get a multiple choice question on the AP that says, if you add something to a random variable, what happens to the mean and the variance? And using this formula, that would mean you would add a to the random variable. B would be 1 and a would be some number. And when you add the variable, you do change the mean. You increase the mean by a, by what you add to it, but you don't change the variance. Or you might get a question that says, what happens when you multiply a random variable by a constant? So in this case, that case, you would set a equal to 0, and you'd multiply by b. So the mean becomes multiplied by b. That is, the expected value of y would be b times the expected value of x. So if your original random variable had a mean of 10 and you multiplied it by 2, the new random variable would have a mean of 20. The variance would go up by a factor of 4. That is, you would take 2 squared if you're doubling a If we were doubling the variable, we would take the variance up, would go up by 4, or the standard deviation would go up by 2. Okay, so that's the y equals a plus bx. Then we have the sum of two random variables. That is, if w is equal to x plus y. In that case, the expected value of w is equal to the expected value of x plus x, the expected value of y. If x and y are independent, and that's an assumption that you either need to make or needs to be given to you, if they're independent, then the variance of w is equal to the variance of x plus the variance of y. Now, it is not the case that the standard deviation of w is equal to the standard deviation of x plus the standard deviation of y. What you have to do to get the standard deviation is take the square root of the variance of x plus variance of y. Okay, so that's the sum of two random variables. Next, if you have a scalar variable that is normally distributed, and you're asked to find, like, what's the probability that we'll fall in a particular range? Remember that we had sort of the hat sizes that were distributed normally, and you want to find the probability that someone will have a hat size that's in the medium range. Well, you use the Z transformation and norm CDF to find the probability that a variable will fall in a particular range. Conversely, to go from a percentile to a standard deviation, you use inner norm. And to go from a standard deviation to natural units, you use the Z transformation. You're working it kind of backwards in that case. Next, suppose you have a binary variable, that is a question about how many successes you'll get in n trials. In that case, we use the binomial distribution. And binom PDF gives you the probability of getting exactly k successes in n trials. Binom CDF gives you the probability of getting k successes or fewer in n trials. Finally, if you have a binary variable and the question is about how many trials it will take until you get to the first success, then you use the geometric distribution. The mean of the binomial distribution, that is the expected number of successes in n trials, is equal to np. And the standard deviation is the square root of np times 1 minus p. The mean of a geometric distribution is 1 over p. That is the average number of trials until you get a success is 1 over p. Okay, now we get to the final topic, which is the biggest topic in this course, statistical inference. And here there are a lot of keywords. Parameter, remember that's the unknown parameter. The only the omniscient knows the true parameter, the statistician does not know it. What we know is the statistic. There's the central limit theorem, which I'll get to in a minute. Bias, meaning that your estimate of a parameter is not centered around the true parameter. The bias often comes from a poorly designed study. And then there's sampling variability, which is the fact that when you take a sample, you're not going to get exactly the true parameter. You're going to get some variability around that parameter. When you increase the sample size, you can reduce sampling variability. In fact, sampling variability goes down with the square root of the sample size. But you do nothing about bias by increasing the sample size. You're just taking a larger bias sample. So bias is something you have to control by designing the experiment properly. Sampling variability is something you control by varying the sample size. Confidence interval, again, we've got to have the definition of that. Null hypothesis, alternative hypothesis, the difference between a two-sided alternative, type 1 error, type 2 error, significance level, that's the sort of boundary or threshold level that you set for rejecting a hypothesis, the p-value, critical value. Critical value is the value that corresponds to the significance level. Measured in natural units. So if you say you're going to reject the null hypothesis that, let's say that that some fish has a length of 6 inches, and you reject it at a significance level of 0.05, and that may correspond to a length of 8 inches, and that length of 8 inches will be the critical value. So the critical value is the value in natural units that is implied by the significance level that you choose. Power is the 1 minus the probability of type 2 error using a specific alternative hypothesis. Okay, then we get to some other keywords. T-test, matched pair t-test, that's where you use sort of before and after comparisons. Two sample t-test is where you compare to the average of two groups. One proportion z-test, that's where we're looking at proportions rather than scalar variables. Two proportion z-test, comparing two proportions. Chi-square we use for two things: the goodness of fit, where you had some prior expectation about how a group of categorical variables would break down. Let's say you expected 40% in one category, 30% in another, 30% in another, and then you compare the actual to that. Test for independence is when you have two categorical variables. Think of them as, one is a row, one is a column, and you're trying to see whether those two categorical variables are independent or not. Regression equation, that's where you're looking at two scalar variables to see how they're related. These things that we can calculate are R squared, residual, standard error of slope, T statistic for slope, P value for slope, and so on. All right, things to remember: the central limit theorem. And that there's always going to be a question on this. The central limit theorem states that as the sample size increases, the distribution of the sample mean becomes normal, with a mean equal to the population mean and a standard deviation equal to the population standard deviation divided by the square root of n. Okay, so there it's saying, and the underlying population may not be normally distributed. So you can have a population that comes from any distribution. Could be skewed, it could be binomial, could be anything. But when you take a sample mean, the expectation is that the sample mean will center around the true mean. So that's point one about the central limit theorem, that is, you will tend to center around the true mean. Point two is that it will tend to be normally distributed. That is, even though the underlying distribution is not, the distribution of your sample mean will become normally distributed. And the third point is that the standard deviation of your sample mean will approach the population standard deviation divided by the square root of n. That's just the familiar sigma over square root of n that we use all the time. Another thing to remember: the null hypothesis is always an equality, and the alternative hypothesis is always an inequality, except when we're calculating power, which I won't get into here. Very important to remember that when the p-value is lower than the significance level, that's when you reject the null hypothesis. Very important to be able to keep that straight, understand why that is. Next, we have type 1 error. And the definition of that, that's rejecting the null hypothesis when it's true, sending the innocent person to jail. Okay, now power, as I said, is 1 minus the probability of a type 2 error. The closer the power is to 1, the better the test. To calculate power, you take two steps. First, we pretend that the null hypothesis is true. That's what we always do when we do a hypothesis test. We pretend it's true, and we find the critical value at which we would just reject the null hypothesis. So let's say we had a diet pill, and the null hypothesis is that you lose no weight on the diet pill, and based on the sample size, you calculate that you would reject the null hypothesis if the average weight loss was 8.5 pounds. In that case, 8.5 would be the critical value. Okay, so we've calculated a critical value. Then we say, all right, let's forget the null hypothesis and then pretend that alternative hypothesis is true. Let's say the alternative hypothesis is that the diet pill causes you to lose 12 pounds. Then if we figure out the probability of reaching or exceeding the critical value that we found in A. That is, we're assuming that the alternative hypothesis is true. The alternative hypothesis is that people lose 12 pounds on this diet pill. And we want to find the probability that if that's true, what's the probability that they would lose only 8.5 pounds? And that is the probability that we would fail to reject the null hypothesis, because if they lose 8.5 pounds or less, we will fail to reject the null hypothesis based on our critical value. So that we fail to reject the null hypothesis, but we're now making the assumption that the alternative hypothesis is true. That is, that you would lose 12 pounds. So again, the probability that you would lose 8.5 pounds, given that the true mean were a loss of 12 pounds, that would be an example of a power calculation. Okay, next remember that the one prop Z test and two prop Z tests are used for sample proportions. The goodness of fit test I've described comparing the distribution of responses in a categorical variable compared to some previous assumptions. And the test for independence is two categorical variables. For example, you could use the letter grade in statistics and the number score you get on the AP. So you'd look at the number of people who get A's and fives versus A's and fours versus A's and threes. You would have all those categories. You'd have maybe 25 categories out of that, and then you want to see whether they're independent. In terms of writing up your answers, always state the null hypothesis in words. Define the parameter. Let mu equal, and then spell out in words what the parameter is, or let p equal if it's a proportion. Once you've defined the parameter, then you can write H naught and HA in terms of the parameter. Then you state the type of test. Then you list all the inputs you have put into your calculator for the calculation, and then give the results. Also, it's very important to remember that certain assumptions must hold for tests to be valid. You want to state these assumptions even if you're not asked to do so. So, for example, with a t-test, if you have a very small sample of, let's say, only 8 or 9 observations, the assumption is that the underlying population isn't too far from normal. Once you've got more than 30 observations, you don't worry about whether the underlying population was normal or not. For chi-squared, there's the no more than 20% of the expected cell counts should be less than 5. That's kind of a rule of thumb. So those are examples of the assumptions. Finally, state your conclusion in words. That is, we reject the hypothesis that, and state it in words, or we fail to reject the hypothesis that, and state it in words. Finally, for regression, the important inference concerns the slope coefficient of the regression. You don't really typically care about the intercept. The ratio of the coefficient to its standard error is a t-ratio with the number of degrees of freedom equal to n minus 2, where n is the number of observations. A low p-value, you can calculate the p-value, or often the p-value will be given to you, or will come out of the calculator. A low p-value means that you can reject the null hypothesis of no relationship between x and y in favor of the alternative hypothesis, which is that there is a relationship.